Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Experience the thrill of the race with Scalextric, proud sponsors of the Motorsport Podcast.
Throughout the history of motor racing, the drivers have always been the big stars, always in the headlines. But their performance on the track depends on some brilliant engineers. This Motorsport podcast series explores what it takes to handle the greatest drivers in the sport by talking to some of the greatest engineers. These podcasts are brought to you in association with Scalextric, and we're joined today by our guest, Gary Anderson. Gary, in the 1970s, was a mechanic at Brabham before moving to McLaren. And in the 80s, he crossed the Atlantic to IndyCar, working for the Rick Galles team. Then it was Jordan, wonderful green Formula One car that I think we all absolutely love. Then it was on to Stewart Grand Prix and Jaguar. And then in 2003, Gary went back to Jordan. So how we're going to cover all that in 1 hour, I don't know, but we'll go give it a try, Gary.
Yeah, we'll give it our best shot. Yeah, it's been a long time, but it's been an interesting time.
Absolutely. You got a really good break, didn't you, by going to Brabham? That was in the mid-70s as a mechanic. And I wondered how much you learnt from being around Gordon Murray.
Well, a huge amount. You can't not learn from somebody as clever as Gordon is, but the big thing is you've got to want to learn. I mean, I actually went to work for Brabham in 1972. I was working at racing stables at Brands Hatch. I'd just come over from Ireland at the beginning of 1972. And I started work on a building site, as you do as a good Irishman. but I got a job driving dump trucks, so that was okay. That developed into meeting somebody, and I got a job at MRS at Brands Hatch at the racing school. And again, somebody there gave me an address and said, oh, look, you know, the Brabham are looking for some people to build Formula 3 and Formula Atlantic cars. So my wife wrote a letter, and I got an answer back from both Bernie Eccleston and from Colin Seeley. Colin ran the sort of production side. Colin's letter said, sorry, but we haven't got any vacancies. And Bernie's letter said, thank you very much for your inquiry. Yes, we have a vacancy. Can you come and see us? So that was pretty confusing to start with. So I went there and I got a job building Formula 3 and Atlantic cars in the latter part of 1972. And then again, in the beginning of 73, you know, I always worked hard, but beginning of 73, they offered me a job on the F1 team. So a boy from Ireland was heading off to Europe to do some motor racing and get paid for it, which is the most exciting thing.
Yes. Tell me, though, I wondered if you'd always wanted to be a driver rather than an engineer, because I think you did some racing, didn't you?
Yeah. Well, the reality of it is I think everybody wants to be a driver. You know, you see that side of it. You see the driver side of racing. And you know, I come from Ireland. We used to do things with cars. You know, those were the days whenever you could open the bonnet and look in there and say, oh, look at that, there's an engine. And you could do something with it to make it go faster. If you want it wider wheels, you sort of got an axle out and cut the rim in two and weld the piece into it, you know. So you always did stuff to drive cars, and I did a bit of rallying in Ireland. But then when I came to England, obviously, the MRS at the racing stables, one of my payday was I could get 10 laps in a Formula Ford around the club circuit at Brands Hatch, which was always good fun. But I did want to drive, yes, but, you know, at 6-foot-odd tall, and having had a couple of pints of Guinness in my time, I was probably overweight and too tall, so... You try. I did try in the mid-70s to have a go. That was what Anson was all about to begin with initially. But again, you realise how much it costs and, you know, you just don't have the money or the talent. or the willpower or the fight. You need a huge amount of that.
Yeah. You just mentioned Anson, and for those who don't have long memories, this was you, I think, and Bob Simpson from Tour. Yeah. So at this point, your plan was to be a constructor in your own right.
Yeah, I mean, I would work for Brabham. We'd built Formula 3 and Atlantic cars. I did a bit of Formula 1. I was always somebody who wanted to learn, so I would sit down in my toolbox with Gordon Murray there and ask him why did that do that, or what was suspension geometry, or why did that go up and down or in and out or whatever. And because of that, I got an opportunity. Whenever they needed, a rear anti-roll bar bracket made up, Gordon would give you a sort of rough plan and say, could you do something? So you'd make something up to make it work. So I got a sort of initiation into what the design needed to be. And obviously then you start dreaming and thinking, right, okay, I can build these cars ourselves and I can drive and so on and so forth. So we took a Brabham BT38, bits of a Brabham BT38 we bought from Bernie and put it together a bit differently, stressed the engine and one thing or another, and ended up with the first Anson, really, which I drove a bit. And then a guy called Richard Parsons drove it. It was pretty decent. It wasn't a bad little car, but, again, it's the same old thing. We were two people in a shed at home, yeah, back of a butcher's shop, and my wife making tea. So, it was either a go away on honeymoon or buy a drawing board. We chose the drawing board.
This was a fantastic grounding for you, though, for what came later, wasn't it? Because you were doing, you and Bob Simpson, you were doing everything yourselves, and therefore you weren't outsourcing stuff like we see today. How much did you benefit before you went off to McLaren? You must have felt much more ready to become a Formula One engineer, if you like.
Well, yes. I mean, there's nothing like actually sort of having to sit down and, I suppose, design a few bits or come up with solutions to problems, I call it, which means you end up building a car. And in those days, again, you were taking a lot of stuff, bits and pieces from all around the place and trying to put it all together. So you taught yourself in a way how to draw stuff and how to make mistakes and how to recover from mistakes. And That was good for me. I mean, that took me to McLaren. And again, McLaren, I was willing to learn and they gave me an opportunity to sort of get involved in stuff. I would be sort of Teddy Mayer's right-hand man as far as engineering was concerned. And because Teddy tended to get distracted a little bit from it all. So, I would sort of try and pull him back a bit. But every day is a school day and you've got to take it in that way. No matter whether it's Formula 3, Formula Atlantic, Super V, Formula 1, whatever, it doesn't really matter. You always learn something new, and you try to understand something new.
What was Teddy Mayer like to work with, Gary? Did he give you all the freedom that you wanted?
It was a strange time in McLaren's life. They just won the 76 championship with James. I joined him in 77, and it was a time whenever ground effect cars were starting to come into vogue with the Lotus, and they were a bit late and all that sort of stuff. So, I remember we went testing at Paul Ricard and in 77, and the two Lotuses were miles ahead of James, who was third quickest in the McLaren M26. I mean, whenever I joined McLaren, the M26 was parked up in the corner of the workshop because it had carbon fiber, composite cockpit sides, which James didn't like because he thought if the car goes upside down, how do I get out of it? And also the way the gear change was routed, it meant that changing gear, you had to think about it a bit. It didn't try to flow down your arm. So one of the first jobs I got whenever I went to McLaren was to take the M26 and try to make it into a car that the driver could drive. So it was quite a challenge, how to reroute all the gear change. We did the cockpit sides so you could just hit them with your elbows and they would fall off. So he was happy enough with it. And that got us to sort of move from the M23 to the M26. But then, as I say, ground effect cars came in at the same time. So we were way behind the ball with that. And we were at Paul Ricard at a test. I say there was two Lotuses. They were the quickest two cars, and James in the M26. And we were sitting at dinner the night of the test, and I'd taken my wife there out for a little bit of a honeymoon. It was at Paul Ricard. And we were sitting down on the beach at a restaurant, and a conversation came out of the ground effect cars, and Teddy said, do you know anything about it? I said, well, it's just a wing upside down. You've got to try and make work near the ground and generate some downforce. So I said, well, you best get back home and do something about it then. So I disappeared back to England, left my wife in the south of France, and started work on a crashed M26 that we had from earlier on in the season, and tried to build up something that resembled a ground effect car. It was a learning curve, and it was called the M26E. It ran at Brands Hatch, but, you know, not successfully by any means, but it was a learning curve to get skirt systems working and, you know, all that sort of stuff. You have to learn about a lot of that stuff.
You mentioned James Hunt being concerned about how he would extricate himself from the car upside down.
Yeah.
What was he like to work with, Gary? At that stage, he was still he was ambitious still, he was competitive still, wasn't he?
He was very, very talented. I think he was very talented at anything he did. The big thing was, you know, he didn't really want to be a racing driver. He just wanted to do something successful. You know, he loved tennis, he loved any of that sort of stuff. He was into it. But when we went testing and tried to go testing in those days, I mean, the last thing James wanted to do was drive the car. You know, he just, any excuse to get out of driving, really, because he knew that when it came to putting in the lap, you know, he would do it. It would be okay. He wouldn't have to, all this background stuff. Obviously, when it didn't work out for him, he was disappointed in it. So I would have said it was what we know James Hunt as for this current day, is somebody who was living a life that he wanted to live, and he needed some of that stuff to bring him the air stewardesses, I think you might call it, because, you know, they were interested in him. He was a hero, but motor racing had to bring that to him because that's what he wanted out of life. So it was the best thing for him, and it was a pleasure to work for. He liked a bit of fun. You know, he came to my first housewarming party, him and Hottie in the stretched limo outside the house, and the first thing he did was organise all the parking so that people could get into the house. And, you know, he was always stuck into things. So he was a nice guy. I enjoyed working with him, but the last thing he wanted to do was drive a racing car.
That's frustrating for an engineer, though, surely, isn't it? Because you do need feedback from a driver when you're engineering a car, don't you?
You do. I mean, it's a very different Formula One today than it was way back then. You know, still the good teams won, but your commitment was Friday morning to Sunday night, and as long as you did that right, testing was a bit of a luxury. If you did your weekends and you focused on them and you had all the stuff around you that you needed, you could manage with that. It was still, you know, it was a sport then. It's not, you know, it's a big business now. When you consider, I mean, McLaren was a big team at that point in time, but that big team was probably 20 people, 25 people maybe at the most. And that was, you know, making your own cars, doing all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
So a very, very different world from this 1,000 that the Formula One team has currently.
Sure. In 1979, you had Alain Prost there. I'm thinking that's a very, very different character.
Yeah. Well, he tested with us at the end of 1979 at Paul Ricard. That was his, you know, his first outing with a Formula One car. And with the Marlboro backing, they were quite keen on an American driver. So we did a sort of back-to-back test at Paul Ricard between Alain Prost and Kevin Coogan, and John Watson was the regular driver, and so John went out in the car and did a set of time, boogie time type thing, and, you know, all quite happy, and Alain got in and went out, and he was very, 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 very careful about everything. You know, he left the pits and, you know, no wheel spin and didn't miss gears and all that sort of stuff, went round and round a few times and come in, said, oh, we've got a bit too much understeer here, whatever. And we sort of fiddled with the car a little bit, and then sort of come to near lunchtime, and we said, okay, it's time to sort of strap, put the seatbelts a bit tighter and get on with it. And off he went, and bish, 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 you know, four or five laps. Suddenly he was quicker than John was. And that sort of woke everybody up a bit. Thought, well, this boat's okay. Then he came in, and we stopped and had lunch, and then it was Kevin Coogan's turn. So Kevin, typical you know, he didn't learn anything from Prost. Out of the pits, you know, wheel spin, missed the next gear, you know, stalled or whatever. Did all the things that opposite to what Alan Prost done. But after a couple of runs, Eddie called him in and said, look, you know, the thing is, you should use up that return ticket to America because I don't think it's going to work out. And because he came in, he was complaining about vibration, and none of us paid any much attention to it because it was that point in time whenever, you know, he didn't have a tire truck. He had probably two sets of tires to last the whole test. Anyway, after he had gone, got Prost back in the car, and he said, oh, you know, maybe we should put on a different set of tires because those tires have been, you know, run a bit now. We said, oh, leave that to later on. No, he said, I think we need them. What he'd done on his in-lap, just before lunchtime, he had sort of slightly flat-spotted these tires. So that whenever Kevin got in there, he couldn't see very much of the vibration. So again, he was quick, but he was also clever. And those sort of things are important. You know, he did it for a reason. He knew that there was a Formula One drive available, and he needed to do the things right. So, no, he was very good. Alan was a completely different beast. He just, you know, he was just car mad, car orientated. Just everything had to be about the car. Get the car better, get the car better, get the car better. And then he could do his job.
Was that a challenge for you to have a man like that in the car? Because it was the first time really now, I think we're talking about you working with someone who went on to be, you know, a multiple world champion and has this reputation for being a perfectionist.
Yeah, everything's a challenge. But as I said earlier, you know, you've got to take these challenges because everything we do, we want to do better. We can do so, and you need all the parts of the jigsaw there. And he became a very valuable part of that jigsaw. He was the jigsaw. He was the final piece. You know, you always start around the outside, around the edges, and get all that right with a jigsaw. And you know, you need that last middle piece to fit in there and make it work. And the driver becomes that part. So I never really worked with him long enough at that point in time because we had a change of plans, my family and me, and we head off. Morris Nunn at Ensign had been asking me to go there to sort of become more of a more engineering orientated, and I decided to do it and move up from, you know, the south of England up to the Midlands to near Chesterfield where he was based at. So we decided to do that because we wanted to sort of end up doing, you know, some sort of different life from the rat race. So I moved up there in 1980 and started work with Ensign, Nigel Bennett. You know, they designed the car and I sort of got it built, really, I suppose you could call it. And it was, you know, it was a good little car. Clay Regazzoni drove it. Yeah. It started off life as a pretty good little car, but then Clay had his big accident at Long Beach, which was something that was a bit irritating, but it happened and, you know, broke his back. And that was, for a small team like that was a massive blow. But these things happen. Motor racing is dangerous. You know, it says so in the back of the ticket, so you've got to pay attention to it sometimes.
You had a much bigger change than that by going to IndyCar. Why did you decide to do that, bearing in mind that you were now pretty well established as an engineer in Formula One?
Yeah, it was difficult because, you know, variety is a spice of life, I think you might say. What happened after Clay had his accident with in the Ensign at Long Beach, and looking at all the details of what happened, you know, the brake pedal was broken, and I had a discussion with the designers at Ensign, and you know, there was a bit of like, oh, I don't think that happened, and that happened in the accident, it didn't cause the accident. And anyway, whatever happened, and I decided after that it was time for me to try to resurrect Anson. So for 4 years or so, we put Anson back together again in the Midlands and built Formula 3 and Super V cars. We even built a sports car. So we did quite a lot of work at that point in time. The big problem again was money. You know, we went 1 year, we built three cars and they were good little cars. But because they were good little cars, the next year we got orders for like 20 cars and we couldn't build them. You know, we couldn't even think about building them. We got them done in the end. I mean, one couple of championships. We won the Super V championship. We won the German championship. We won the Swedish Formula 3 championship. So we had a successful little car, but we always had money problems. And a couple of guys came in and were going to fund the team. And at the end of the day, they had less money than we had. But they convinced us that they should become part of the team. And then that was the reason I went to America, was because I had been doing a bit of work out in America with our own Super V, with various drivers out there, fairly successfully. And then Rick Gallus wanted an engineer to come out and engineer at the weekend. So I said, why not? And they had various drivers in the team. Pancho Carter was very good at ovals. Roberto Moreno and Jeff Brabham were obviously, they were more road circuit type people, but Jeff had a bit of oval experience. So, you know, there's a good variety there. And it was a very, very good learning curve. I mean, I think some of the engineers that's current in Formula One could learn a lot out there, because if you engineer a car with somebody like Pancho Carter driving it around a 7/8 mile oval at Sanair, and the car is going past you every 18 seconds, and the pits are open all the time, you know, so yellows, you just have to live on them. It's an experience. You pay attention, you know, you pay attention big time. You're dizzy after the race. But, you know, it's a big, big learning curve, but it's a fantastic experience. It's great racing.
Can you tell me a bit about the engineering of a car on the short oval like that, which, as you say, is very, very quick. It's turning left all the time.
Yeah.
This is a whole new world.
Well, you know, there's a wide variety of approaches, but the reality of it is that because the car wants to turn left, or the car has to turn left all the time, basically the driver's job is to keep it from not turning left. And then you free the car up, you let the car do its thing when you arrive at the corner. You don't actually turn it into the corner. You let it do its thing. You just stop it from not turning left. So you just ease up the load on the steering wheel and the car itself dives into the corner. So corner widths, cambers, you know, casters, springs on the corners, everything can be different, but depending upon whether you know, the car is, as they call it in America, loose, in other words, oversteery, or if it's pushing, understeery, you know, that's how you sort of trim the car with all the different setups you can put onto it. It's very similar to the high-speed ovals, but obviously Indianapolis, Michigan, Pocono, those sort of tracks, it's just a lot less downforce, but it's a fairly different setup. But in reality, it's the same. You're trying to do the same thing, allow the driver to keep the car from turning left. And when he wants to turn left, he just eases up his load. It's like taking your hands off the steering wheel going down the motorway in your car. It'll go straight on, but any car will turn left. So that's your objective, is to make it do that without having to be hard work.
That's really interesting. I've never really heard so much about that. Is that because you want to minimize the movement on the steering wheel because of the high speed and the proximity of the scenery, if you like?
Yeah, I mean, obviously the walls are very close for a start. But what you have to do is try to make sure that the car, you don't have to force the car to do anything. And you or I or anybody really could drive the car down the straight and there, or let's say Pocono or Phoenix or Michigan. It's one of those sort of things that it's in the middle of the corner when you're doing 200 plus mile an hour and the wall is about 10 feet away, that you don't want it to go wrong. So that's where the car needs to be comfortable, get the car comfortable at that point in time in the corner. So, you know, arriving at the corner, as I always say with any racing car, arriving at the corner for the driver and giving him the confidence to turn the steering wheel is where the driver gets his confidence. That's the first step. And if the car is good to him at that point, then he'll take the car through the corner faster. And Indy, it's one of those sort of things, or any oval, one of those sort of things, when you arrive at the corner, you just want to ease up the load that you got on the steering wheel. It's keeping it from turning left and just let it turn itself. And then you know the car wants to do that. You're not forcing it to do that. The car wants to do that. And as I say, going down the straights, the time you're keeping the car turned left. So it's more theoretically mid-corner and the ovals, there is less load in the less torque on the steering column, for example, than there is going down the straight, because just the car wants to turn left. So yeah. You're not making the car turn left. And that's what you got to do with the setup, is try to get to that point where the car, you're a passenger in the car through the corner, because it wants to do that. And all you're trying to do is keep it straight between corner to corner.
The engineer-driver relationship there, I'm assuming, is really important, because he's got to feel total confidence.
Yes, you know, you don't get a second chance at sort of heading into a, a, a corner at 230 mile an hour if it goes wrong. You know, so that's that. You're a passenger. Now, not all those ovals are at that speed, but you know, you take Indianapolis, Michigan, Pocono, they are. And when it does go wrong, it's an airplane accident, you know, that speed. So it's something that, yes, you can build up to, but the car changes dramatically as you build up to it. So you've got to try to get to the point where the driver has the confidence to take it into the corner. And then from there on in, once you get through that stage, then you'll trim the car and trim the car and trim the car. So instead of arriving at the corner at 230, you might be arriving at the corner at 240. So that's where you get that last bit out of it. And it's very, very difficult because, you know, half a millimeter ride height, a little bit of wing, a touch of gurney flap, a little bit of cross weight, massive, massive things change the car dramatically. So you need to be really, really careful that you build up to it slowly. But if you build up to it too slowly, the car will change whenever you do actually build up to it quickly. So you've got to be really careful of that, stepping across that line. It's a very interesting thing. As I say, some of the engineers in Formula One currently could do with a lesson in IndyCar, and I'd stop them thinking this is easy. It ain't easy at all.
Back in Europe, you took Roberto Moreno to the Formula 3000 Championship. Yep. You won the championship with him.
Yeah.
And I was always interested in Moreno. To me, always seemed an incredibly talented driver who somehow never really quite made it. Can you tell us a bit about working with him?
Yeah, I would agree 100% with what you say, Rob. But, you know, very, very talented, exceptional to work with from an engineering point of view, because the feeling he had was second to none in the car. And sometimes, actually, I think that was his downfall. He wasn't one of these drivers that laid it on the line. He needed, like the Alan Prost of what we talked about earlier, you know, he would want to work on the car, work on the car, and work on the car. And that year we won the championship, for example. We went to Po, and we'd been to Po the year before. We had a Rolt at that time in Bromley Motorsport, and Corroyser was driving, who was a good little driver and all that stuff. But, you know, you go out and you go around Po and you learn Po. It's like Monaco. You need to do some laps. Roberto would drive out of the pits, go around, come into the pits. Now, it's got this, you know, it's got a bit too much understeer. The traction's not great, whatever. Every lap we were sort of optimizing. Near the end of the session before qualifying, I said, look, you know, it's time to do a lap time. Why? And I said, because, you know, I'd just love to see a lap time. He said, yeah, but the difference in what I'm feeling and doing a lap time is driving down a straight line. That's all the pit straight is. It's a straight line. He said, I can do that anytime. So I would rather spend the time optimizing the car. So, okay, you can't really argue with that. He'd been there before. He'd done a good job. And he, you know, out in first lap qualifying, put it on pole. And you know, I couldn't argue with him after that. And then, you know, he led the race. So getting the car right is very important to him. But there's other circuits where that really didn't work as well as it could have done. But I think that was his downfall, was the fact he was so, so into the engineering side of it and making the car as good as possible. It really was, you know, that was important to him. So I think he missed the boat a little bit by not just getting out there and wringing the car's neck at every opportunity he could.
And that's interesting, yeah, because Poe is quite a challenging track, isn't it? It's got, as you mentioned, the long straight past the pits, but it's very, very fiddly, some of it, isn't it? It's which, I mean, I assume you need to have the car pretty spot on for those.
Yes, I mean, there's areas where, you know, the circuit topography, the surface of the circuit, you know, Monaco has got a lot of camber chains across the track, but that's got nothing to pull. You know, if you have the right height wrong, you can sit in the middle on the skid underneath the car, with no wheels on the ground. So it's some of those circuits which it really is demanding. And at that point in time with Formula 3000, we ran cross ply tires as well. The thing about cross ply tires was that with speed they grew, and that meant you could run much lower ride heights at low speed. I mean, basically, if you monitored the ride height, which we didn't do very well, but we tried our best, you actually ran a very stable ride height all the way around the circuit. just from the fact the tires grew at high speed. When you had more downforce on the car, the tire got bigger, and at low speed, the car was closer to the ground.
Now we come to, I guess, the part that everybody remembers. How could we forget the Jordan? How did Eddie Jordan convince you to come and design a Formula One car?
Well, it was a strange thing, really, I suppose. I mean, I'd known Eddie for many years. We competed against each other when I had my Anson F3 cars in the early 80s. He was very good at taking my sponsors. But we had a good little car, so it was all right. We got to know each other quite well. And then in 1988, obviously, we won the Formula 3000 championship. And, you know, Johnny Herbert was in the Reynard, which would have done a fantastic job in the works car as such. He broke his legs at Brands Hatch. But for 89, I'd never worked in a drawing office with qualified engineers. Everything I'd done, I've taught myself or learned from whatever, from good people that sort of helped me. And I went to work for Reynard in 1989, designed their Formula 3000 car. And that sort of led me to the end of that year. Eddie approached me at Birmingham Super Prix, first of all, and said, look, you know, I'm trying to put it together to build a Formula One car. Would you come and join us? If I do, and I said, well, yeah, why not? You know, and I thought it was a joke. I thought I'd never hear of him again. And then just prior to Christmas 89, my phone started ringing, and it was Eddie. You know, yeah, I think I've got enough money to put together a prototype. You know, well, do you want to come and design it for us? No, I don't. And he called my wife a few times, convinced her to talk to me. And I told him that I needed at least three of us, you know, because it's not a one-man job. And he said, okay, yeah, right. So two of the guys that worked with me at Reynard, Mark Smith and Andrew Green, I talked to them. They had to give a month's notice. I'd given mine because I was going to go and work for Eddie. And Eddie said, oh, yeah, you've got a drawing office. Everything's ready to go, blah, blah, blah. So I got there. I think it was the beginning of February. There was no drawing office. There was no nothing. There was a mezzanine and a builder bloke who did Eddie's DIY stuff. And away we went. We sort of put up a wall or two here and there. And I spent the month before Andrew and Mark could come, getting all the catalogs and bearing books and, you know, all that sort of stuff, composted, you know, all the catalogs you need for all the supplies of stuff, setting up a few contacts for manufacturing bits and pieces, because we weren't going to get the car manufactured 100% outside. Got that all ready. So whenever Andrew and Mark came, we had three drawing boards and a big layout board, and away we went. And it was very interesting because, as I say, Andrew sort of set into the suspension area. Mark started designing the gearbox and engine installation. The two of them met up mechanically, and I schemed up the car and did the wind tunnel work down in Southampton University. I never ever thought the car would get built. I genuinely never thought it would happen. And then I think it must have been about August, Eddie came in and said, I think we're on, said, I think we've got a couple of sponsors coming in. I think we can get the car built now, which is what we did.
This was an incredible achievement, bearing in mind that you built this Grand Prix car completely from scratch. And as soon as it was launched, it caused quite a sensation because, apart from anything else, it was a beautiful looking car. And in some ways, the rear of the car was a little bit ahead of its time, wasn't it? That sort of the way it was wasted in is, that's layman's language, but
I've always said that, you know, you try to understand stuff. You try to make sure that what you're trying to build, you have a clue as to what you're trying to get out of it. I met up with John Watson, who had worked with, obviously, at McLaren through the years, and in the very early days at Brabham, at the British Grand Prix in 1990. And John stopped, no, you know, you're building a Formula One car with Eddie, you know, what do you guys know about Formula One? You know, what are you thinking? I said, well, all I can do is try to build a car that's driver-friendly. We're going to have to do pre-qualifying. No idea who's going to be driving it. But if we have a car that's driver friendly at 8 o'clock on a Friday morning, when we have to go and try to do the best job we can, it'll be possible. If the car's too tricky to drive, then you know we'll make lots of mistakes. And he said, "Oh yeah, that's not easy to do." And I said, "No, I know it's not easy to do, but if that's what your objective is, then you know you might achieve it." So whenever it came to testing the car the first time, I said to Eddie, "Look, why don't we get another Irishman? Why don't we get John to do the shakedown test?" And after about three laps, John came into the pits and he said, "You know, this car is exactly what you said back in July." He said, "That's what it feels like." So I love a car like this. It's sort of got a docile front end, but the rear is really secure under brake and turning in and all that stuff. So that was nice. And then Andrea De Cesaris joined us, and then Bertram Gascio. The first big test, really, I think, was Paul Ricard. I think it was the beginning of January. And I remember having worked with Alan Prost at McLaren. We were in the garage. You know, we had these little green toolboxes from Halfords. And there was probably about four of us, I think. And Alan Prost and Fiorio, the team manager at that time at Ferrari, standing outside the garage, looking in, with Prost saying to him, "How can they do that?" Because we'd been out for our first day and we were quicker than they were. Obviously, it was fuel and all that sort of stuff. It didn't really matter. But at the end of the day, just the fact that it was a nice-looking car, looked as though it was quite quick. And Prost shaking his head with the team manager from Ferrari saying, "How can they do that?" So quite good fun.
It's a great story. And one of the reasons it's a great story is because the car had huge potential. I mean, let's just take, you know, as the obvious example, the Grand Prix at Spa, when Eddie somehow managed to get Michael Schumacher into the car. So now you, by this time, you knew you had a pretty good car, and now you've got Schumacher. What do you remember about that weekend, Gary?
Well, it was one of those sort of strange weekends. Obviously, we were still a bit stunned by what happened to Bertram, because none of us ever thought they'd end up in prison. And you know, the Schumacher thing then unfolded for various reasons. And you know, he came to the workshop at Silverstone to get a seat fit and all that sort of stuff done. And I remember sitting talking to him and saying, "Oh, you know, it's great. Spa, obviously, you know Spa from the sports car days." He said, "No, I've never driven it. I've never been there." And I thought, "Oh God, here we go." But anyway, once he drove the car at Silverstone, you knew that he was either going to bin it or be quick. And it was just quick. It's fantastic car control. And again, because the car was like it was a sort of docile car, it suited him for his first day out. I think if he had, you know, because there was talk of him driving the Arrows or whatever it was, or footwork or something, that point in time. And I think if he'd gotten another car, it wouldn't have been the same debut by any means. Not because we were better than they were, but just because the car suited a new boy in time, getting into it and having to wring its neck with very little experience. So that was good. But then obviously, you know, we were hampered by budget and we ended up getting hand-me-down stuff from, for example, AP. There was this clutch hub, which was an aluminium clutch hub, which was lighter. And we had the Cosworth HB engine, which had a bit of a problem in the back of the crankshaft. We had to run a lighter weight clutch than you should do on a Formula One car. And obviously this aluminium hub that we got as a hand down from AP because nobody else wanted them, because they had made a new titanium one, which was would stand the heat better. Nobody else wanted them, so they give us what some of them. And Spa being the uphill start, a single plate clutch, which got very hot, an aluminium hub, which to take the drive from the plates into the gearbox, just and inexperience from Michael, he sort of did a very good start. And then at the hairpin, had to do a sort of another start. And that was just too much heat for the clutch and just killed the clutch. So it was one of those sort of situations where part of it was because of budget, part of it was because of naivety on our behalf, and part of it was because of inexperience on Michael's behalf. So all of that combined to his race being about 200 metres.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Do you look upon, maybe one of these people who never looks back, but do you look upon that time at Jordan in some ways as a huge lost opportunity, bearing in mind how good the car was? You had Schumacher, albeit that wasn't going to be a permanent thing. But had you had better finances, it could have been something really great, could it not?
Yeah, I think it could. The big problem really is the fact that I wouldn't really say the finances held us back dramatically. I think it was just our experience and our ability to sort of set ourselves a target and focus on it. And the finances would have helped that. We had a target set there. You know, we had stupid things. Monaco were running sixth and the throttle cable broke. Emily, we had a gear selector break, and we were knocking on the points as well. And remember, in those years, you only got points to sixth. You know, you could have a fantastic season, finish seventh in every Grand Prix, and have zero at the end of the season. So, you know, scoring points was no easy task. And obviously, we scored our first points in Montreal with a fourth and fifth, which was fantastic. And Monaco's always been kind to Jordan in a way. You know, I think we finished second in 97. We finished second and third in 95. So we always had a good run there because we always built an efficient car. But I think going back to 91, I think it was near the end of the season before we sort of felt that we were, before I felt we were actually in a reasonable control of what was going on. But at that point in time, we were financially strapped. And, you know, 92 and 93 just was survival, you know. It was just a matter of making sure we were still there.
I'm just going to take you back in time for a moment because these podcasts, we do them with our partner, Scalextric. And I like to ask people, when you were a kid, did you have Scalextric? Did you race your mates in any way?
Yeah, no, I did have Scalextric. And actually, interestingly, you bring that up because the one corner that sticks in my mind that relates to Scalextric is coming out of Peratello in Mexico. And that was the first, we scored our first points the race before in Montreal, but standing there through that bank corner at the beginning of the race and watching, you know, a Williams or whatever it was, a Williams or Ferrari, someone else and a Jordan coming out of that corner flat out. That was like Scalextric to me. That was just what it was. It was just like, this thing's on rails. It was the first time I realized that we were really racing with the big boys. And that was the first race where, you know, it's so visual, the exit of that corner. And it was just amazing. And as I say, it relates to Scalextric because it is like it's on rails.
That's a great image, I tell you, because that's what it was like with Scalextric, wasn't it? You kept your thumb down.
Yeah.
And the car held on.
No, it did. And that's what, through that corner, that was part of it. You know, you once you committed to the corner, that was it. Your throttle was where it was, the speed was where it was, and you just hoped you got to the end of it because it was a mighty corner at that point in time. And it's just, as I say, it just relates to Scalextric all over again.
This podcast is supported by Scalextric. Listeners can claim 10% off all Scalextric products by visiting www.scalextric.com and using the code RACE10. That's RACE in capital letters, followed by figure 10, RACE10, at checkout. This offer is valid until the 30th of September this year and cannot be used in conjunction with any other offer. A full list of terms and conditions is available on the Scalextric website. I wanted to ask you a little bit about Rubens Barrichello, because I spent quite a lot of time when he was in Formula 3, and he was very nervous. He was a very nervous character, quite jumpy. I often wondered, for such an apparently sensitive young man, he became a good Grand Prix driver. So I wondered what he was like to work with when he was with Jordan.
It was very good. You know, he joined us at the end of a bad time, I suppose you might say. We had a lot of struggles. So it was a very difficult time for somebody to join us and hope for success. But from the first day he drove with us, I got on really well with him. And he sort of adopted me as his second dad. And 93, 94, I engineered his car as well, as, you know, was technical director there. So we got to understand each other very, very well. And I suppose I believed in him and he believed in me. And I'm a big believer, as you said earlier, in relationships between drivers and engineers. You know, at that point in time, we didn't have all the data in the world. You didn't bring the car into the pits and plug in the umbilical cord and get out gigabytes of rubbish and try to analyze it. The driver was your tool. He told you what he wanted, and I believed in that. And Rubens and I worked together well at that. And he would tell me what was going on with the car by the time he was entering the pit lane as such. He'd be on the radio. This is what's happening, blah, blah, blah. And I would have some remedies, I would hope remedies for it. And by the time he stopped in the garage and say, look, do this, do this, do this, I'll do that, 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 that. Yep, okay, leave the middle one out. Let's do the other two because I'm not quite sure. And away we go. So you had this quick reference between each other that worked very, very well, very well. And it's one of those sort of situations. It doesn't happen very often, but when it does, it's a good place to be. And he was one of those drivers, like Roberto Moreno. I had exactly the same with Roberto. It's just one of those relationships where it just blends from day one, and away you go. And it's fun to be part of.
And of course, drivers like that make your life so much, I was going to say easier, but they make your life so much more straightforward, because you're not getting too much information, you're getting the information you want.
Well, yeah, you're getting the information you want. The thing is that you're getting it straight from the horse's mouth, I suppose the best way of putting it. You know, if you take drivers, I've had various drivers in the cars. Rubens is one of those drivers who's a fingertip driver. You know, you go around the track with him in a road car, he's just fingertipping it. You go around with some other drivers, they're white knuckling it. And the difference is night and day. You know, they end up doing the same lap time. That's all okay. But one of them is just a gorilla in the car, and the other one is, you know, just letting the car do the work. And that's something you have to do. If you're going to report back as to what the car is doing, you have to make sure that you're not inflicting half of the problems. You have to allow the car to do its job and then come back with the problems and then find the solutions. And that way, I think Rubens was excellent. He allowed the car to do its work, and he just gave it a bit of a helping hand as to where he wanted it to go.
Interesting. That's interesting. Yeah. You decided to leave Jordan, and you went to the team that Jackie Stewart and his family put together with the Ford Motor Company.
Yeah.
The obvious question really there is why? Why did you do that? Because you'd had quite a lot of success at Jordan, honestly.
Yeah.
And it had gone from, you know, an empty shed to...
it was probably one of those... I tend to make spur-of-the-moment decisions on silly things. We had a good 97, let's say. The car was pretty good. We had the odd podium, and we should have won a couple of races probably, but we didn't. We had the Peugeot engine, which was at that point in time its third year with us. And we had worked very hard to try to make the engine work with Peugeot to get the engine to be a better package, which I think we succeeded in doing. And then at the end of 97, you know, they were going to go to Prost. So 98, we moved to the Mugen Honda. So it was another engine for us. The regulations changed quite a bit, and the track width and, you know, all that sort of stuff, the groove tires and stuff. So we ended up, you know, it was a whole new car package. It was a new engine installation, a new working relationship with engine people. And 98, we started the season poorly. And it wasn't as though it was a black and white reason. It's a bit like Mercedes, you know, last year, I suppose you might say. You know, everything we'd done to the car meant that it was theoretically a better car than the 97 car. It had, you know, relatively as much downforce for the, with the changes. It had, it was lighter, it was stiffer, it was everything. But the engine itself was way down on the Peugeot engine. And the car, from my point of view, the driver didn't like the car. The car didn't make sense to the driver, neither to Damon or Ralph. Ralph would muscle a car and get a lap out of it, but Damon, you know, with his experience, didn't want to be doing that. So that was, you know, during the beginning of the season, I had four trips to Japan after each of the first four races to try and work with Honda to get them to recognize that what they had wasn't good enough, whilst trying to also identify the problems that we had with the car. And it was quite strange because I instigated some aerodynamic tests after the fourth race of the season. And I've always liked to try to make sure the guys know the answer before they ask the question. And then if the answer you get for that question isn't the same as what the answer you think should be, then you question why. And the answers we got to this was very different from the answer I thought we should be having. So we researched it a bit and found out the reasons why it was happening and set about fixing it, which meant new front wing end plates, new side pods, you know, fair amount of change around the front wheel architecture. And it was all going to be ready for the British Grand Prix. My last trip to Honda, which, you know, it was Mugen Honda badge, but it was really Honda built the engine. They sort of bought into the fact that they were way down in power. And it was quite strange because we're sitting around this big meeting table talking about it. And one guy in his white uniform got up, headed off, went to the dyno cell, came back with this dyno report as such, punched in the kilowatts and punched in the figures and said, exactly the power you say we have. Said we thought we had about 40 horsepower more because it just didn't sort of relate to it. So they instigated a huge amount of differences, and I had to stay that night and go through with them in the morning what we could do, and, you know, because it meant new exhaust systems, new airbox, new lots of stuff, new radiators. They were changing the engine architecture dramatically, all for the British Grand Prix. So everything was coming for the British Grand Prix. But during that period of me trying to get my head around the fact that we didn't build a bad car, we just didn't build as good a car as we thought, the management, and I'm not putting Eddie into this, but management at Jordan didn't put their arm around my shoulder when I needed it most. And I decided that on the way to that, I decided, look, no, I'm going to make sure this stuff gets on the car. I'm going to make sure it works. And then I'm out of here. So we did that. British Grand Prix came up. We scored our first point. It's not much, but the drivers liked the car. We got about 20 horsepower from Honda. The drivers liked what the car felt like. And I went to Eddie on the Monday morning and said, Eddie, I'm out of here. Sorry. And why, you know, I don't want you to go, I want you to stay, blah, blah, blah. I said, look, this is the reason. I'm sorry, but this is the reason. And there was a guy outside Eddie's office, which was doing trimming a tree with a chainsaw. And he went open this window and gave this bloke the biggest Irish bollocking you've ever given anybody in your life because of the noise. But that was the reason for leaving. And I didn't leave with a job to go to. I left with nothing to go to because I didn't believe in, you know, covering your tail before you decided what you wanted to do. So I left with nothing, and that sort of developed them to go to Stuart. I did visit Prost to see because of they asked me to go and see them, but that was a very French team, and with Peugeot coming in, being a bloody nightmare, which it turned out to be. And I met with Jackie after Spa, and he made me an offer. And I must say that my year 1999 Stuart Grand Prix was a pleasure to work with somebody like Jackie Stewart. He was just such a people's person. You know, he just knew everybody's name and the kid's name, and if the kid had a cold last week, and every Tuesday after a Grand Prix, we used to walk around the factory, him and I, and, you know, good or bad, didn't really matter, but speak to everybody about stuff. And just, you know, he just was a people's person.
He's a remarkable man.
Remarkable, absolutely remarkable man, yeah.
Another driver, Johnny Herbert. Johnny does a column in Motorsport magazine, so we might want to tread a bit carefully here, or not, as the case may be. He's a lovely bloke, but he's a tough competitor, isn't he?
Yes, he's a very tough competitor. I mean, you know, that accident in Brands Hatch in 88, it's hard to say it ruined his career. It didn't do any good for the next 5 years of it, I suppose, for sure. And then he sort of built his way out of it a little bit, but not to the extent that he would have been if 88 had flowed for him the way it should have done. And, you know, the offers, the drives had come that he should have done for 89, 90 and so on. Now, I'm saying that you've still got to make all the right decisions, be in the right place at the right time, all that stuff, who knows? But I think Johnny was somebody who was, you know, an excellent driver, very competitive. And whenever I got with him in 99, it hadn't faded away, but it wasn't at its peak. You know, he won a Nürburgring in adverse conditions with us and made the right decisions, drove well. Everybody else was crashing. That's life, you know. The thing is that the lights go out and the checkered flag waves, and in between that, you can do what you want. And he was very good at keeping it on the road. Should he have had better success? I think one of the things that I would say, and I'm not being critical of him by any means here, was that during practice sessions, we get Rubens, you know, during, you know, the practice session before qualifying, Rubens would be fourth quickest or fifth quickest, and Johnny would be sixth or seventh or whatever. Go out for qualifying, Rubens would be, first run would be fourth quickest or third maybe, and Johnny would be 17th. And I never really understood why that would be. He seemed to need the laps to get the confidence to push to that limit. By the end of a practice session, you were able to do that. But it didn't come easy in qualifying for him. I think it was Monza whenever we sort of saw a bit of a breakthrough. We had a different differential, got an active differential working. And that made a lot of progress for Johnny. Very little for Rubens, but a lot of progress for Johnny. So whenever he was fifth, sixth, seventh, whatever in practice before qualifying, he could now go out and be fifth or sixth or seventh in qualifying. That made a big swap for him. Rubens would still be doing a good job. And, you know, again, it was the same old deal. We weren't a massive team, so we made mistakes. We weren't as consistent by any means as we should have been, and that was both driver and team. But it wasn't bad, and that led to the Jaguar or Ford takeover as such.
Just coming back to Johnny for briefly, he obviously had this, you know, God-given talent, like some of these drivers do. So did he drill down into the detail of the car, or could he drive round stuff?
He was good at driving round stuff because I think he was naturally talented. Again, as I say, Rubens was very good at being going in depth with the car and trying to drag the best out of the car before he would, you know, put it on the line. But Rubens was also very good at putting it on the line. You know, he knew when it came to it. And I think if you look back at 94 with the Jordan, when he was on pole and Spa in half dry conditions, and Nürburgring when he was on pole in the wet for Stewart, those are the type of conditions that I'm saying. Give him the chance. Just give him that nip of a chance of doing something. And he knows the pressure of doing it. He can go out there and bring it back for you. I don't think Johnny was quite there with that. I think Johnny, with the car good, equal set of circumstances where he didn't have to go out and feel the grip on the track or anything, he could just go and drive the wheels off it. I think Johnny was pretty good. But it took him a long time to get in terms with what Rubens could do with that, the Stewart in 99. It took him a long time to do that. But I think part of that was the fact that Johnny would have to build up a little bit and get that confidence, whereas Rubens could, you know, go out the pits and nail it more or less immediately. And that's really what happened to Rubens in qualifying in Imola in 94 in Jordan, when he had his big crash on the Friday. You know, he was flat tacked on the first lap through that last chicane and you know, a little bit wide, clipped the curb, it's a hole in the road, and he's a passenger. So, yeah, there's times you get away with it and there's times you don't. But, you know, the drivers, I think, really, really are committed to everything. It's the ones that can go out there on that first lap and really wring its neck. And I think we see that with Max Verstappen currently. Yeah. You know, there's never a session where he's not nigh on fastest on that first lap. Yeah. So, yeah, it still bodes true.
Not sure what to say about Jaguar, really. the Stewarts, I mean, okay, they decided to stop and they sold the team to Ford. Mm-hmm. And on paper, the Jaguar looked like it had potential, that team, but it just never got going. It never worked, did it, Gary?
No, it never worked. And I'll tell you sort of some of the reasons. I mean, if you take the sale, I was in California. We used the Swift Wind Tunnel in Los Angeles, just outside of Los Angeles, with Stewart and with Jaguar. And I was there for a test just before the Montreal Grand Prix. And Jackie phoned me up and said, what are you up to? And I told him, and he said, when are you coming up to Montreal? And I said, it was Tuesday night or Wednesday night or something. And he said, why don't you come up tonight? He said, I'm in Detroit. Why don't you come up to Detroit and we can have dinner? And I said, I'm busy. I'm ready. He said, no, you should come up. Honestly, you should come up. I'll arrange all the flights. So the secretary called me. These are the flights. All they get, go to up there, picked up, taken to the hotel. There's a three-piece suit hanging in the wardrobe and a pair of shoes, because I was obviously just had team gear with me and stuff. See you for dinner at 7. So I went down for dinner at 7. There's Jackie, Helen, Enzo Ford. So Jackie, Helen, myself, and Enzo Ford and myself. And he said, I just wanted you the first to know that we sold the company to Ford. And he said, I think, just would like you to know about it. So thank you very much. That's amazing. Now, that's the difference between what happened at the end of the season when the company was sold and Ford took over. It was like a light switch went off. It was all the same company. But, whereas I just said there, I was in a wind tunnel test in California. I got banned from doing that. I was told by the bosses that I should not be doing, I should be managing. I'm not a manager. I've got dirt under my nails. I like getting dirt under my nails. I get stuck in. That's my job, to understand stuff and get stuck in. And that really was where I saw the problem. And, the top management joined us in an engineering meeting at Jaguar, as it was then, the beginning of the Jaguar life, and walked into this meeting with about 20 people there and said, you either do it Ford's way or we'll get somebody else that will. Now, that's motivation for you. Yeah. And as the year went by, I just, lost interest a bit, really. And by the end of the season, I had a big barney with one of the head guys in Malaysia, because we just got to the point of actually, behind their back, identifying and fixing the problem, which should have been fixed probably by race 4. But no, wasn't allowed to do it. And we'd done some stuff, made some P34 packers for the diffuser, body filler packers for the diffuser, stuck them in there, and it transformed the car. So, simple things, really. But they didn't see it that way. They were Ford. They were the might of Ford. And, it was really, really a horrible place to, a horrible job, because you knew the problems, but you couldn't go about fixing them. And then we had good guys. It's not as though the guys were wrong, but you needed to pull it together and you needed to bring the message back. And it was sort of like your hands were tied. So, I didn't enjoy it. And when I got a phone call from a certain Neil Wrestler to tell me my job wasn't necessary anymore, I thought, okay, bet down with that, because we could have got out of this, but never mind.
Yeah, it's not a great story, is it, actually? And it's an example, isn't it, in fact, of how huge multinational companies, they're not racing teams. No. I mean, if you look at Red Bull, for example, it's a racing team, isn't it? That's what it is. It doesn't do anything else. I mean, I know it makes drinks, but
yeah.
It's a racing team. And I think from the way you've described it, once it gets corporate like that, it doesn't work, does it?
Well, the big problem I had was really there was probably underneath the top management at Ford, there were 8 other sort of second line managers, and they were all just looking after their pension. They'd say yes to anything, up, down. They'd agree with the top management, and it didn't matter whether it was black and white lies, they'd agree. And you couldn't get through that, because they were the ones that were believed. They were there every day. They were chatting about how Eddie Irvine would qualify 12th or 14th or whatever it was. You know, how that's really, really ridiculous, and how this is the mate of Ford, and he should be on pole position. And yet you say to him, well what do you do to fix it? Well, that's not our job. No, you have to pass that on down. But then will you let me try to get on with it? No, you have to pass it on down as well. So you sort of end up with, you have this group of people, nobody's any responsibility. And it is corporate management. There just seems to be that sort of pass it down and hope that somebody along the line picks it up and does something about it. And I could tell you some horror stories, but this is not the time or place for them.
Well, I don't mind a few horror stories another time, maybe. we're nearly out of time, Gary, but 2003, you went back to Eddie, back to Jordan.
Yeah.
Sometimes people say you should never go back. You did.
Yeah.
In retrospect, was that a good decision?
Well, after the Jaguar thing of 2000, I worked for Raynard in America, looking after the IndyCar people, you know, sort of technical director in America, going back and forward. And that was a good experience again, because I had IndyCar experience, I had Formula One experience, and I think the teams and I got on quite well. We did some developments, and it was a year where it was all getting a bit high pressure for Raynard, and we ended up winning the championship via Penske, but still... Castro Neves still ran, the Raynard spec car as opposed to the Penske spec car in the last races, and you know, he won the championship. So we did do good things. And then I spoke to Eddie at the American Grand Prix in Indianapolis, and he said, "Look, you know, can we do something about getting you back again?" And I said, "Well, I don't want to go back as technical director, but I'll go back. You know, I'll think about coming back. I want to come back to England anyway, full time because of family and all that stuff." And I said I would come back and sort of look after the racing side of things. So I didn't go back to do the same job. They had, unfortunately, during my period away, was probably their most financially sound period, where they had very good money from Deutsche Post and B&H and all that sort of stuff. And that was really why Eddie asked me back, because that money was starting to diminish a bit. When I did go back, I went back for 2002. Started back. And my first job, I got called into the office, and there was a guy there from Deutsche Post and Eddie. And they said, you know, we need to cut back our overhead a bit. You know, I said, well, I'm just taking the job, so you sack me now, you know, one day in. I said, no, we want you to look at the amount of people we've got and who we could let go. So my first day there was not a good day, because we had to cut back. And so I became Mr. Hatchet Man, I suppose. Yeah, well, it's one of those difficult things, because whenever you have to do that and reduce the staff, you know you're going in the wrong direction. So it was one of those situations where 2003 was trying to see whether or not we could survive again enough to pull in some decent. And by the mid part of 2003, it didn't look to me as it was going to happen. So again, I decided to move on and let them get on with it. It's difficult, because going back to the company you worked for before, and also the company you had built from nothing, you know, as I say, there wasn't even a drawn office. The company had changed dramatically, and not all for the right reasons, I suppose you could say. But it wasn't bad. It was just one of those sort of situations. Eddie was fighting to keep it alive, but then even he got tired of it and obviously went up for sale. So I started doing a little bit with Dallara, because they had a deal with Midland to build a Formula One car, and it was actually me that suggested, instead of Dallara building an F1 car, why didn't Midland have a chat with Eddie, who wanted to get rid of a Formula One car? Maybe the two could meet in the middle and everybody would be happy. But yeah, it didn't suit me, and I didn't really... I wasn't at home with the Midland people as management was concerned. I'd been through the Ford management, and I didn't need another set of people coming in that knew nothing about it, trying to tell me what to do. So time was to hang up the pencil.
I want to ask you finally, Gary, for your take on Formula One today.
I thought these regulations, when they come in, it would be a bit, basic, but actually it's turned out quite interesting, because, you know, from my experience of ground effect way back in the 70s, trying to sort of come up with ground effect, which you had to do. I mean, all the early 80s, late 70s, early 80s, that was what it was all about. Whether you had an F3 car, a Super V car, a Formula One car, whatever, you had to generate downforce from underneath the car. So it's been quite an interesting time for me to see how people went about that. And as we know, looking at the grid, it's not simple. And I think Adrian knew his knowledge from way back in my time with Indy cars and various other formulas through those years has bowed him pretty well. But I agree with you at the minute. The only thing I would say is the cars are too big. And you take, you know, it's highlighted at Monaco, but never mind that, it's highlighted everywhere. The cars are too big and they're too heavy. And I made a suggestion a while ago where I would, if it was me, I would sort of hit the 10% button. And I'd say, right, let's just make the car 10% smaller and 10% lighter. And that's a big challenge. But if you looked at one of these cars, there is so much stuff on them. Yeah. And they talk about safety. Yeah, okay, safety is important. But there is so much actual stuff on them that you could get rid of. And it would mean you wouldn't have that, you know, two bucket loads of data. You might just have one bucket load at the end of the day, but you'd have to prioritize stuff. And, you know, I think the challenge for the weight has got to be hard. It's got to be difficult to do. You can't just complain to the FIA that, oh, we can't meet the weight limit. You know, you have to throw some of the stuff away that's around the car. It doesn't have to be there. And obviously then, you know, the weight formula will define itself. There will be cars that will be lighter than other cars. That's the way it's always been. You know, that is the challenge of Formula One. As I say, my simple term would be just hit the 10% button for 2026 and then go ahead. You know, that brings it down by, the minute that bring it down by 79 kilograms, nice round figure, say 80 kilograms or whatever. Brings it down to sort of 720 rounded up, which is still 100 kilograms heavier than when I was last involved in the design of a Formula One car. So you can do a hell of a lot of safety within 100 kilograms. And weight is not necessarily always the best for safety. You know, you just got to be careful here. So I'd set the challenge pretty high. I'd make the car 10% narrower, 10% shorter, 10% less overhang. Just, it's a simple thing to do, you know. Doesn't have to be 10%. It could be 12. It could be 8. But you know, 10% is a nice number to me. So that would be my big thing at the moment. And I'd again simplify the front wings dramatically because the cars are—they're still not able to follow each other well enough. So that needs to be sorted out a little bit. But step one was okay, and the regulations going to the ground effect. But now it does need step two. And step two for me would make a smaller car. And just make it generate a bit less downforce and a bit less optimization of aerodynamic surfaces, especially the front wing, which is the first thing that sees turbulent air change. Yeah. Because, you know, no team develops their car in the wind tunnel to work in turbulent air. They develop it to get the best lap time out of it possible. So the regulations need to make the front wing robust enough to withstand turbulent airflow. They've done a bit, but, you know, it needs to be simplified a bit more.
It's interesting, isn't it? At a time when the media tends to concentrate on the star drivers, as I said right at the beginning of this, but actually what we're seeing from Adrian Newey is the continuation of an absolutely staggering career. Mm-hmm. And one of the people with whom he worked closely went to Aston Martin, and lo and behold, it's now the second quickest car. So from an engineer's point of view, it's remarkable. And also intriguing, isn't it?
Well, yeah, from my point of view, it is intriguing. The thing is, it's not just about black and white numbers that you get from the wind tunnel or CFD. It's about your aerodynamic philosophy. What you believe in. And I'll go way back to the Jordan 191. You know, I wanted a car that might not have as much downforce as other cars, but it would have a good secure rear end on the braking and corner entry. And we built it, had a monoshock front suspension, so in slow speed corners it had a bit of understeer. But that all gives the drivers, you know, some confidence. So if you have a philosophy within the design of a car, you end up with a product that you understand. And that breeds through the people that you work with. And that's where, obviously, anybody that's been at Red Bull will have some of that will have rubbed off Adrian. And they, you know, they themselves will have brought some questions to Adrian's philosophy, but and that might have made his philosophy sort of diluted a little bit. But still, it will carry that direction where, you know, the aerodynamic philosophy, how you spec the car to begin with, is not just about we're going to achieve, you know, 3.6 efficiency and X amount of downforce. It's what happens when you turn the steering wheel, when the car yaws, rolls, when you change ride height, braking at the end of a straight, and then turn the steering wheel, or when you don't brake and you go into a fast corner, just accelerating. You know, everything's different. Everything's transient. And that's that philosophy, that how you manage that transient condition that makes a car good or bad. And you could take, you could probably put, you know, let's say the Mercedes in a wind tunnel, fixed ride height, sitting there quite happy against a Red Bull. And it probably will produce more downforce, but give it some transient effects where that's on the move all the time. And no, it doesn't give the driver confidence. So it's a chicken and egg with the engineer and the driver to me. You know, you need both, but the engineer needs to have that philosophy. And I think that at the end of the day, Adrian, with his little bit of driving that he did or does, it helps. You know, I remember whenever I had drivers complaining about the position of the brake pedal or something, I related it to me driving and how, you know, you needed these things to be just second sense. You didn't want to have to think about them. And that's the sort of philosophy I'm talking about. Having a little bit of experience driving a car does no harm whatsoever.
Interesting. That's been a very interesting hour and hour or so. Thank you very much, Gary.
No problem. Yeah, no problem.
I still love the Jordan 191, I must say.
Yeah, it's a nice car. I'm proud of it. You know, obviously I should be proud of it, but I am proud of it genuinely because it's a car that I put my life and soul into. And of the cars that I did put my life and soul in, the 91 Jordan, the 94 and the 97 were probably the three cars where I committed myself 100% to what they were. And we didn't read magazines. We didn't pick up Autosport every Thursday to see what was the pictures were in there. We actually thought about it and created it and the reasons behind it. And that's important, I think. That's where you get your aerodynamic philosophy from. And it's important to believe in yourself and what you're trying to do.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think it's a good rule for life, isn't it?
Okay. It is, yeah. No, it's a good rule for life. Nothing's different from the one. It's just from the one, but it's life.
Thank you very much, Gary. Thank you.
No problem, Rob. Thank you.
Experience the thrill of the race with Scale Extric. Proud sponsors of the Motorsport Podcast.